Hello, everyone. Today is Monday, April the 6th. Welcome, everyone, to today's conference call on the state of the investment markets. It's a bit of a new world, to say the least, that we live in right now. As an aside, we're using a new service called Zoom for this call, a real sign of the times in virtual meetings. My name is Bern Silberman. I am the District Vice President of Manulife Investments and have the pleasure of working with your advisors at KLS. Rajiv Kudzia, Cameron Leith, and Paco Sanchez. Today, my role is the operator of the conference call. We have put the conference call on mute for everyone but the speakers. I will shortly hand over the call to Paco Sanchez, who will start the call. Your advisors at KLS have received a number of questions in advance by you, the participants. Rajiv Kudzia and Cameron Leith will go through as many of these questions as time will allow with our guest speaker, Philip Peterson, at the end of this presentation. Thank you for joining us today, and I will hand it over to Paco Sanchez.
Well, thank you, Bernd, and good afternoon, everyone. My name is Paco Sanchez, Senior Financial Advisor at Kudzia Leith Sanchez. And let me start by thanking all of you for joining us on this call today. We also welcome on the call with us clients of Kamal Kimitrai. We certainly are in some unprecedented times, and we understand that people are feeling anxious and concerned for their safety and for the safety of their loved ones. We understand that people are concerned about their investment portfolios as well, and what this might mean for them and their futures. We know that as clients of the firm that you are looking to us for assistance, and we carry that with great responsibility. This is the very reason why KLS has taken some extra measures to try and help with how you might be feeling, and by bringing on today one of our heavily relied upon sources for his wealth of knowledge in the investment landscape around the globe. As mentioned, we have Philip Peterson joining us today. He is Chief Investment Strategist for Manulife Investment Management. Philip has frequently been seen on media outlets such as BNN as an expert on economic issues. Philip, I will pass it over to you so you can share with us your thoughts on the current landscape.
Thank you, Paco, and thank you, Cameron and Rajiv, for having me on. I do appreciate the time that you've given me to speak to your clients, and at the same time, I do wish everyone a safe and healthy, daily routine as we go about in solving this coronavirus. The more we do together, I think, being apart, the faster we can get through this. Let me just mention a few key things that myself and my team are thinking about right now. And the first one is, as we go through this and as the information comes about every single day and as the information changes, I'm just amazed at it. I've been in the business over 25 years and I've never seen anything like this before. I have no benchmark to what we are experiencing and what we're living through, what we've been living through for the last number of weeks and what we're likely to continue to live through for the next couple of weeks. I've been working at home now for 3 weeks as our company put the stay-at-home, mandate in place. My work day has been fairly normal in that I have everything available to me, but watching the markets move and fluctuate as they have has been something that we haven't seen for quite a while. That shouldn't mean, though, I don't believe that people should take that to mean that this is the worst environment that I've ever seen. Because I don't believe that that is the case. And that's mainly because of how this recession came about. First, I want to say that despite all the research that my team conducts, we couldn't have predicted what is happening in the economy and markets today. This is a recession and bear market of a different making. And this is why preparedness is key. So let me just say, in terms of why this market or this recession is different, is because of how it came about. This was basically an engineered sudden stop to the economies in Canada, the United States, across Europe, and around the world. And this is something that is quite fascinating, and that we've never seen this before, where governments have just said, stay home. Unless you're an essential service, you can't work. That is quite different than what we've seen in the past in 2008, in 2001, in recessions in the past, going all the way back to the Great Depression. And that is what gives me a little bit of optimism that despite some of the numbers that we're seeing right now, which are awful in terms of the job losses, I believe that once the government hits that play button, saying that the economy can get back to functioning in a normal manner, that the recovery, I think, will come fairly quick, or quicker than what we've seen in the past. Now, the reason for that being, again, is because this is a government-mandated sudden stop to the economies in Canada and the United States. It can be effectively a government-mandated start. That's different than 2008. 2008 and 2001 and all the way back to 29, those recessions or the depression of 1920, of the 30s, really came about because of an excess in the environment or bubbles, asset bubbles. In 2008, it was U.S. housing and the credit markets associated with that. In 2001, it was dot-com. Even in 1929, it was an industrial bubble where we had massive excess capacity of manufacturing in the roaring 20s, plus a massive amount of leverage that led to the collapse of the equity markets. We didn't have that today. And so that is what gives me a little bit more comfort that we are likely to get back to normal at some point, and in fairly quick order. That normal may be a little bit different in the future than what we are familiar with, but normal nonetheless. Now, bringing it all back together, we say hope is not an investment strategy, but neither is panic. And we say that because panic can drive us to make mistakes. For example, panic drove the cannabis boom in the first quarter of 2018. So panic can work in two directions. Panic can trigger a response that drives investors into the market for fear of missing out, just as panic can drive investors out of the market for fear of some great loss, as we saw in December of 2018. Now, this is different than fear, right? Fear is a normal response to what is going on. If you're nervous, that is a completely reasonable reaction to today's environment. What we need to do, though, is stop that fear from turning into panic and prevent mistakes that have been made time and time again by investors. And as such, so how do we get past this panic, and how do we avoid fear turning into that? Is that we continue to emphasize discipline, fundamentals, and a balanced approach to investing. What we've seen in the past is that if you continue to remain disciplined, if you stick to a process, stick to your goals, objectives, and rebalance, you're in a far better position than what we've seen in the past. Now, what are governments doing and central banks doing to help ease the issues? We've seen massive amounts of fiscal stimulus out of the government of Canada, out of the government in the United States, as well as central banks, both Bank of Canada and the Federal Reserve in the US, but central banks globally and governments globally. In Canada, the fiscal stimulus is close to $200 billion, and I expect that to continue to climb. The Bank of Canada has reduced its target rate to 0.25%, so dropping interest rates to extreme lows. They've instituted a number of programs to support the credit markets or support lending by businesses and so on. And so this is a bridge between the sudden stop and the start that we will get back to at some point. And so this isn't an immediate solution to everything, but it should help alleviate some of the pressures that we're seeing on various aspects of the economy. Now, I do believe, again, that we are in a recession in Canada. It might not be a typical recession of two quarters of negative GDP growth, because you know I think we are closer to the end of this than the beginning. And so therefore, while it might not be an official recession, it certainly is recessionary conditions though. The bear market, or what we've seen in the equity markets, has come, I would say, equally fast and furious in terms of how quickly the market has dropped. And today I would say is no exception, with the volatility to the upside, where we're watching the Canadian and US equity markets up about 5%, from where we were on Friday. I believe markets are now starting to price in the expected earnings drop that we are estimating to be around 15% year over year, or a drop of 15% in profits year over year. And valuation now is starting to look more attractive. So we would say that we are more than halfway through this bear market. Now that does change with the volatility, but what from the levels where we are today and what we have seen over the last couple of weeks, our outlook over the next 12 to 24 months has started to improve. Now with that, the average bear market typically sees a drop of about 35%. As of 2 weeks ago, we did see that. The markets were down approximately 35%, and we've been bouncing around, say, minus 25 to minus 30 over the last couple of weeks. We do think that there potentially is a little bit more downside. However, what we're recommending and what our portfolio managers have been doing over the past couple of weeks is taking advantage of the volatility. And so there are a few things that we recommend at this point. And I'll just put them in the context of what our portfolio managers are doing, say, for example, in balanced funds. The first one is rebalancing. An average Canadian investor will have an asset allocation of 60% in equities and 40% in bonds. If the markets are down 25%, as they are roughly, then that equity weight will be pushed down to about 45% of the client's portfolio. Our managers in a balanced fund have seen roughly the same thing, but what they've been doing is rebalancing back up to that 60%. And this is a form of dollar cost averaging, if you will, but it takes advantage of the drops in the market and shifts from one asset class that has held up fairly well into an asset class that is at depressed prices. What we've seen historically is by rebalancing to a targeted asset allocation, again, we'll use 60-40 as our benchmark, that portfolios have a faster recovery time than just sitting on the asset allocation and not changing it at all. So what our managers are doing on your behalf is rebalancing. The second thing that we're doing is taking advantage of these price dislocations at the individual company level. And so there have been a number of companies, the whole market is down, but a number of companies have been, we can debate rightly or wrongly, but overly punished in terms of what is going on in the current economy and what is projected to go out over the next couple of months. And now these companies are trading at extremely low levels, and these companies are of extremely high quality. And so our managers are taking the advantage to quality up, as they're calling it. Whereas some companies that we own, some stocks that we own in the portfolio might not have fallen as hard as others. Therefore, when we look at the upside potential, we see better upside potential in some other stocks out there. And so we're rebalancing into those. Those are something that we're taking advantage of on the financial side, with the banks trading at very attractive levels. At the industrial side and consumer sides, where we have auto companies and airlines, for example, that are priced as if no one is going to get on a plane again, and we just don't think that's the reality. And so we do think that there are great opportunities, and we're taking advantage of these opportunities as they pop up almost on a daily basis. And then the third thing that we have been recommending that is important that I've done recently is speak to your advisor. I've spoken to my advisor just again to go over the portfolio, to understand your goals, understand your objectives, and take advantage of some of the opportunities that are out there. I mean, I think the most important thing is to just make sure that you're still focused on your long-term goals and objectives. And I think by doing so, that alleviates a lot of the fear that market volatility like this can stir up, and it helps prevent panic moves. I have had the question over the last couple of weeks, well, should we just go to cash? The markets are down, you know, say 20-25% odd. Shouldn't I just go to cash? And because we believe that we're more than halfway through, we think that is a wrong thing to do. We think that is, we've seen investors do this before. Go to cash at the wrong time, at the bottom of the market, and not return until markets have fully recovered, in some cases years down the road. What that does is it locks in your losses and you miss on the potential gains. We think that is one of the biggest mistakes that we can make. You do want to focus on the fundamentals. You do want to have your asset allocation proper to the fundamentals in the environment. And what that is saying to us today and what our managers are taking advantage of is having that ability to start to rebalance and even increase the equity weight within our funds. Gentlemen, why don't I pause there? And I know you have a few questions that you've received from clients. I'm happy to address those now.
Thank you, Philip. It's Cameron here. Yes, Rajiv and I will alternate asking questions that have been sent in. I had a bit of a scare there partway through the call. I was actually bumped out of the call. So I don't know if that's a function of telephone lines heating up. So in the event that I am lost again, let me get a question in here. So the first one from a client, how long do you expect it will take for investments to recover? How is your crystal ball?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we rely on history for this. A couple things to consider. One, from the economic perspective, we think the recovery will be faster than what we've seen in prior recessions. And so let's think about it in terms of the labor market. In 2008, there were about 8.5 million jobs lost in the United States during the kind of the full leg of the recession. It took 5 years to recover those jobs. In this environment, now the job losses, if we use first-time jobless claims in the United States as our benchmark, they already exceed that, and we'll probably see continued job losses over the next just couple of weeks before things settle out. But imagine all the job losses in a recession really came about over a two-week span. That's what we're seeing right now. However, at the same time, we think a lot of these job losses will be recovered fairly quickly. Again, government says get back to work. Restaurants will be open, bars will be open, shops will be open. And that's where a lot of these losses have come from. And so the economic recovery, or the jobs recovery, we don't think will take 5 years. I think it could take 2 years before we see it. And the majority of that's going to come in the first year. And then the second year, we'll see, I believe, the rest of the gains. The stock market recovery, though, historically does take a little bit longer. And so we have to be realistic here. To get back to the prior level of February 19th, using the S&P 500, the U.S. stock market, as our benchmark, that, too, I believe, could take a couple of years. And I think we have to be realistic there. Because in our view, we shouldn't have been there in the first place. We felt that markets were modestly overvalued, but overvalued nonetheless as we went into 2020. I don't think we're going to see a full recovery, say, in the next 12 months back to the February highs. I think that's a little too optimistic. However, at the same time, I do believe from where we are today that the markets will be higher 12 months out. So I believe a dollar into the market today will be worth more in 12 months' time. That is also what we've seen historically. At these levels, when the markets have dropped as much as they have, when valuation is roughly where we are today, you do see markets gain most of the time over the coming 12 months. So the full recovery to the February highs could be a couple of years out. But if I put money to work, if I rebalance into my portfolio, if I shift my asset allocation into equities or even increase my equity weight, then I believe over the next 12 months or in 12 months' time, I'll be generating a profit.
Thanks, Phil. It's Rajiv. We had another question around the recovery. What do we need to see in order for that recovery really to start? Or maybe in other words, what do we need to see when we might be sort of past the bottom? And what shape do you expect the recovery to take? We've heard a lot about U's and V's and W's. What does your team see?
First on what we're looking for, obviously we're looking for the infectious rate of the coronavirus to slow down globally, not just in any one particular area, but for example, we're starting to see things slow down in terms of the number of new infections in Italy and France and Spain. But the US, we could argue, is 2 to 4 weeks behind in terms of their actions. Canada, I think, was ahead of it. So I don't think we're going to... We have done, I believe, a better job in flattening the curve, so to speak. But it's the U.S. market that we'll have to watch. We're seeing Asia get back to work. We have colleagues in Asia, and they're starting to get back into the offices. And it's almost business as usual, not completely, but we're getting there. And factories are close to 100% operational in China. So when we start to see Europe get back to normal, then I think that's a good sign, because that'll tell us that the U.S. then is probably about 4 weeks away from getting back to normal as well. So that's one of the things that we're looking at. The other thing we have to keep in mind is that, you know, historically, bear markets bottom before the end of the recession, and usually about halfway through the recession. So there, if we think that this is, we're going to get back to normal, say the third quarter, you know, starting, you know, July 1, let's call it that, then, you know, it's reasonable to assume that the bear market will be over in this quarter. I don't think it's today. I don't think it was 2 weeks ago. I think we have potentially one more leg down to see. But it's going to be sooner rather than later. I don't think this is going to be a long drawn out bear market like we saw between 2000 and 2003. As far as the shape, I see the same thing, Rajiv, in terms of everyone trying to put a label on the recovery. We never actually know until it's all said and done. But if you have to hold me to it, I say it looks like a lazy V. You know, it was like one of my kids, you know, wrote when they were like, you know, 4 years old, that sharp line down, that's what we're seeing right now, sharp recession. And then the recovery is just kind of this lazy, you know, long, or not long, but, you know, lazy recovery out. Some believe that we'll see just a sharper recovery before the end of the year. I don't think that's going to be the case, but, you know, nor do I think it's going to be like a 2008 where it took 5 years to fully recover. But, you know, I think 2 years is reasonable. So sharp down, lazy up back, kind of a slanted V. How's that?
All right.
Phil, there's been unprecedented amount of spending by governments on a global basis. So the next is a request for commenting what the long-term impact on the economy and markets will be with the level of debt being incurred by the developed nations.
That's a good question, one that I've been trying to plot out in terms of various scenarios. We know the US government, for example, is going to run up a massive deficit in 2020. They put a $2 trillion stimulus package in. The deficit pre that was targeted to be about $1.5 trillion. So just those two numbers take you to $3.5 trillion. However, we also know that tax revenues are going to be down substantially in 2020. So their deficit could be as high as $5 trillion, right? So that's a meaningful amount of money that has to be raised in the debt markets, not only in the United States, but we're going to see something along the same lines proportionately in Canada, across Europe. If you play this out, what it is likely to mean is higher interest rates, right? If you have all this issuance, it basically comes down to supply and demand. You have a massive amount of supply, bond supply, coming onto the market. If demand stays the same, then interest rates have to go up, right? The price has to drop and interest rates go up. If it turns into the central banks just buying up all the debt, then you're doing what's called monetizing that debt. So you tend to see a devaluation of the currency and higher inflation, which would lead to higher interest rates. So either way, I think what we see 12 months out is, regardless of what the Bank of Canada does on the short end or shorter term interest rate environment, longer term interest rates, I think, are likely to go higher. Just as a function of the excess supply of debt that's coming on the market over the next 12 months. I think that could be somewhat temporary, but yeah, that's what we're going to see, say 12 to 24 months out.
Phil, bonds have traditionally been a safe haven for clients. Can you just talk a little bit about what's happened in the bond market? We've seen a sell-off and client portfolios on the bond side. Not atypical to see them down potentially 6 or 8%, and of course high yield even more so.
Yeah, I would say what we've seen in high yield has been pretty much exactly what you tend to see. High yield usually has about half to say 2/3 of the downside of the equity market, and that's roughly what we've seen this go around. But you did see some dislocations in the bond markets, even on the sovereign bonds, so government bond markets, where they didn't act like they normally do. So they didn't act as that safe haven. When you start to explore why, it's kind of interesting in that the volatility that we saw in the equity markets was so extreme. We saw a couple days where trading was halted early in the morning because we had tripped the circuit breakers, meaning the markets were down, you know, 7 to 10% very, very quickly. The volatility has been at the extreme level that triggered a high number of margin calls. Now, what does the equity market have to do with the fixed income market? Well, you have a number of hedge funds out there that became forced sellers because they were faced with margin calls and they had to reduce their overall leverage in the portfolio. Rather than sell your equity that's down 20 to 30%, you would prefer to sell your bond that's easily traded into cash or gold. We saw the same thing with gold, that gold was actually down and it just didn't make sense. So you had a very short period of time when there were more sellers of bonds just because they were being met by margin calls than what the normal bond market would suggest. And since then, we've gotten back to normal or closer back to normal. Plus the Federal Reserve has announced programs that would support the corporate bond markets, the investment grade corporate bond markets. And so bonds are slowly working their way back and recovering some of those losses. But yes, you're right. It was one of those odd things that we saw. It wasn't a function that the companies themselves that borrow were in trouble. It's a function that the investment community was being faced with margin calls at a very, very rapid pace because of the volatility in the equity markets that became forced sellers, and we had more forced sellers than buyers. The other function of bond markets being down is, yeah, as that happened, you had what's known as mark to market, meaning if bonds, you know, we haven't seen a lot of, or liquidity didn't really pick up much in bonds. And so if you have an issue that's thinly traded, basically that last trade, if someone had to get out of that bond and bid it down, then everyone has to mark that bond lower. And so that created some volatility in bond markets as well. However, you know, I look at it, and while I'm not thrilled that bond funds are down, you know, a couple percent, being down a couple percent in this environment is a lot better than being down 25% in equities. So they do still provide that defensive posture. Likewise, gold. You know, my gold position was down, which was atypical of what we normally see, but you know, it was down by a heck of a lot less than what we see in equities. So yeah, I'm willing to sit on that for the time being.
Phil, another question with respect to volatility. What impact, if any, do the algorithms and passive investments have on volatilities and performance in the last month?
The algorithms, it's hard to get data on that, but as far as passive ETFs, that data is readily available. And I would say that has contributed significantly to the volatility in these passive investment vehicles that are easily traded. And so in the United States, 401k plans, which are like group pension plans, have a significant weighting to passive investing, passive investments. So think like the S&P 500. And it's very easy for anyone to go onto their account and hit the sell button. And we've seen that. And the volume of redemptions that we've seen out of some of the larger passive ETFs, I believe, and you can kind of work the numbers, but I believe have contributed to these rather sharp bouts of volatility that we've seen in the market. And so it's been almost this self-fulfilling prophecy to the downside as it was to the upside, where people were just buying the market. It naturally pushes the whole market up because you're buying the whole market. You're not being selective. And the greatest fear was, well, in the downturn, passive investing is going to create greater volatility to the downside. That was the belief, and now it's been proven to be the case. In a way, though, as an active manager, what it's doing for us is it's presenting some fantastic opportunities on companies that are being sold off just because they're part of the S&P 500, and investors are raising cash to levels that are extremely attractive to us that we think are bargains that we haven't seen in years.
Okay, we have time for a few more questions. A couple more questions from clients here, Phil. One, some people are concerned with the decisions that the United States administration is making just as it relates to how they're handling the virus situation. What impact do you think that has on equity markets and the U.S. equity market? And we also had a question about what you are doing personally with your investments. Maybe you can speak to that as well.
Sure. Let me start in terms of the U.S. I think it definitely is creating volatility, not in the sense that you agree or disagree with what the administration is doing, but I think common sense and what we've seen happen in Europe and what we've seen happen in China is that the longer you delay taking action on this, the longer you delay the recovery, right? And so that is what I think is really being priced into the markets. It's that, you know, I admire President Trump's optimism when he talks about we'll be back at Easter and then has to walk that back and delay it and, you know, my gut says this and so on. But that's just not reality. And so the market, you know, on the one hand, wants to believe that things are going to get better. But on the other hand, we know that we're not there yet. So until the U.S., and there's still 8 states, remember, that haven't taken any kind of action in terms of stay at home and shuttering businesses. So there's still some states that are in denial. And you just sit there and say, the longer that you deny taking action, the worse the problem is going to be for you when that wave eventually comes, and the longer the recovery is going to be. That is why I think, you know, that is what I believe also contributes to some of the volatility and is being priced in. So it's not a statement on whether I agree. It's a statement on, well, okay, we know now the recovery is going to be delayed for 2 to 4 weeks and, you know, keep pushing that out. What I'm doing let me put it that way, because in my portfolio, this might, it's a little bit different than some other speakers out there. I was a little bit more cautious heading into 2020. So my personal portfolio was underweight equities and overweight fixed income through the back half of 2019 and first few weeks of first quarter of 2020. Just because valuation, again, remember what I said earlier, is I didn't think we should have been at the levels that we were. So that doesn't mean I'm all out of equities, 50-50, right? What I've done now, though, just in the last week, is add back. I have been, you know, my equity weight obviously is down. So not only have I rebalanced to that weight, but I've been increasing equities and increasing equities globally. So the first, I'll just let you know, I only invest in funds, one, because it makes it a lot easier from a compliance perspective. And two, yeah, I know the portfolios and the portfolio managers very, very well. I'm very comfortable with what they do. So I've been shifting my portfolio, into, one of our global equity funds, starting to think about the recovery and starting to take advantage of these price dislocations. I know we're not at the bottom, but I'm not going to be able to time the bottom perfectly. I don't believe anyone can, but at these levels, again, what I also know is that historically 12 months out from here, you know, we tend to be up more so than down. So that gives me comfort, and I'm not expecting a rebound in the next 6 months. I think, you know, we'll see it over the course of a year, you know, to get above this level. And then 2 years or so to get back to the prior level. But from where we are today, that looks like attractive gains. So I've started to buy in the last week. 2 weeks ago, you know, my answer would have been, I'm not doing anything yet other than rebalancing. Now it's like, no, I'm actually increasing my equities.
Okay, thanks. So we have time for one more question from Cam, and then we'll wrap it up.
Certainly.
Sure. Let's combine a couple here because they often go together. Expectations around oil and the obviously impact on the Canadian dollar.
Certainly. Well, first at $25, where I think we're slightly ahead of that today, we're around $26 for West Texas Intermediate. No one is making money. No producer is making money at those levels. The Saudis that price in Brent, they're not making money. And so this is right now is a game of attrition. It has brought down the Canadian dollar. The Canadian dollar is exactly where it should be relative to the price of oil. We think that there's only limited downside to oil from these levels. and so therefore limited downside to the Canadian dollar. And with that in mind, we think that over the course of the next year again, so we look at 12 months out, but 12 months out, we do think oil prices are higher, that production is going to be cut. I don't believe Trump's comment last week that he said he spoke to Saudi Arabia and Russia. In fact, they denied it later on in the day that they were going to cut by 10 million barrels a day. But over the course of the next, say, 6 to 12 months, yes, I think we're going to see a recovery in demand and a drop in production to bring the price of oil higher. To what end? I'm using $45 as our target right now, and that would mean a higher Canadian dollar to somewhere between 75 and 77 cents over the course of the next 12 months.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Phil. So that concludes our call, everyone, for this afternoon. Again, I want to take the time to thank Phil for taking his time and providing his insights. And also thanks to Bernd Silberman from Manulife Investments for organizing the event today. Thanks for being with us. Stay safe, be well, and have a great afternoon, everyone.